And here's part two. Excuse me. And as I was saying that when I finally went before the judge, he was saying that, you know, at 15% disability, you are 100% disabled. But when I went before them, the Social Security doctors, I was already at 85%. And when I went before the judge, I was like at 150% disabled. And the judge, you know, he said, you approve. And he told them that they will have to pay me from 2004 up until now. And that was 7 years of back pay that they had to pay me. And he said, yeah, in 2005, yes, the law had changed where you only get paid 1 year. But she was already applied and had been denied before that went in effect. So no, you will have to pay her from 2004 up until now. And I told the judge, I really appreciate it and thank you. Because when I went in for before the judge, I was walking with a cane. And after that, it just start everything just started going downhill because I was still more stressed and everything. And then my son joined the Navy, so that means he had left home, so that just left me and my daughter. So we had to move out the 3-bedroom and downsize to a 2-bedroom for the public housing for Section 8. So when we did that, because everything was fine, long we stayed on the third floor. We were still in the same apartment complex. We just downsized to a 2-bedroom. So the 2-bedroom that we ended up getting was on the first floor. And the apartment complex had started going downhill. And it was just like, you know, they was letting any and anything move in there. Because when we first moved there, everything was, you know, the property looked nice and, you know, it was well kept. And then they end up changing management. Then the property started going downhill, and they started letting all the Section 8 people move in. And they didn't start take. They didn't want to care about the place, you know, the property or anything. It just looked really bad after a while. And then they would sit outside my bedroom window. We was on the first floor, and my bedroom window was right by the staircase. So they would sit there on the staircase and drink and smoke all time of night, sleep all day, but be up all night. And then, you know, and if you say something at the office about it, they tell them who said something. And then they come back and they egg my windows up. It was horrible. And then it got to the point that I wasn't able to walk anymore, so I had a power scooter. They would see me coming on a power scooter. They wouldn't even move out the way. You know, they just stand there. You know, I'm like, I told my daughter, we have to find somewhere else to go. So I got the newspaper. I looked and I talked to Section 8, and they said that I had to stay there. And I told my, you know what? I appreciate everything y'all have done for me, but I can't live in that type of environment with my illness. You know, it just is too stressful, and stress did not make it any better. It was I was so stressed all the time because, you know, I had to, you know, I walked my daughter, you know, ride the scooter to her bus stop every morning and back. And then once I decided found somewhere to move, we ended up moving. It was in the same area, but it was a different community. It was a gated community, and this lady had a condominium that she was renting, and we rented that, and we stayed there for 4 years until my son got out the Navy, because it was a 2-bedroom, and then we ended up moving again into where we at today. But like I said, I went through so much, because like I said, I went from a cane to a power scooter, being bedridden. I was bedridden for about 3 years. I couldn't even do anything for myself. My daughter ended up homeschooling herself to stay home to take care of me. And then the doctors them end up getting a nurse to come in for 8 hours a day to help her out, you know, with me. You know, she would prepare my meals and stuff, and the nurse and stuff would get me up and, you know, get me bathed and changed and change my linens and stuff on the bed and stuff like that, where my daughter cooked food and, you know, stuff, and then she studied and stuff, you know, in all that time. But like I said, it was really hard, you know, because I was the one used to take care of them, to where it reversed when my daughter was taking care of me. You know, my son, he helped out a whole lot because he would make sure he had to set up where money would come home to help with bills and stuff, because he knew that, you know, we still needed help. And it was frustrating, you know, it was very frustrating. When I ended up bedridden, I learned that I needed a power of attorney, I needed a living will. One of the members of my church worked in a law firm. She ended up getting all those paperwork and stuff drawn up for me for free. And I really thank her for that. And she brought them up to me. I was in the hospital. And she brought them up to me to the hospital, and I signed them. She brought a witness. We had a witness to sign them. And then I gave a copy to the hospital while I was there, because they had asked me earlier about that. And so I gave them a copy of it. So all my doctors have a copy of my living will and my power of attorney. I just had one redone because my sister that passed away a year ago, she was on the living will and the power of attorney with my kids, because my kids was minor. They was underage. So I put her over them to help them to decide what to do in case something happened to me. So once she passed away, I redone the living will and power of attorney, since my kids are adults now. So they know, my children know exactly what I want and what I don't want. And I got it set up like that, so it won't be no burden on them in case it get to that point where I can't talk for myself, you know, think for myself anymore. They know what they mom want, and it's right there in black and white. The doctors know it's right there in black and white. And I advise anybody to make sure you have those things in place, for your family won't have to go through the what she want. I don't know, you know, because, you know, I was surprised that my sister that just passed away that didn't have one in place. And she knew, I kept telling her how important it was to have this. When she got sick, you know, I guess she thought she still had time enough to do it, but her doctors lied to her and told her she had 7 years, and it took them a year to diagnose what was actually wrong with her. I mean, you know, they told her this and they told her that, but it ended up she had metastatic cancer, and it was already progressed, and she was already in stage four, and they told her she had 7 years. She was in stage four, where she can barely stand up. And you telling her she got 7 years, but that's a whole another story. But like I said, you know, that's why I could understand why she didn't have one in place. You know, she could have, you know, when I went to go stay with her to take her to her appointments and stuff like that, and cook for her and stuff. And I asked her again, do you need to get a power of attorney, you know, and a living will? So, you know, for we can know what you want. You know, she said, oh, I am. But, you know, she never got around to it. So it left a big gap of what we know, what she wanted, what she don't want, you know, after she had left. So I don't want to put that burden on my kids. That's why I have all this stuff in place, so they don't have to stress about it. I already know. They know. So, you know, like I said, it's a good thing to have those power attorneys, and it's a lifesaver. I can tell you that much. It's a big lifesaver. And after we got moved, when my son came home from the Navy, we ended up moving from that side of town to another side of town, and it was a lot better area. The area that we moved in, it was a big step up from where we first lived. And this one was an even bigger step up from where we was at over there. So, like I said, you know, now we've been over here in this apartment for about, I say 11 years now, in the same apartment complex. And when my son got married, me and my daughter, we ended up downsizing again into a 2-bedroom. We was all staying in a 3-bedroom. But when my son got married, me and my daughter, we downsized and we stayed in the same apartment complex because it's gated. So we downsized to a 2-bedroom. But we are looking to move next year when our lease is up, because now this place is going downhill. I mean, you know, they let in and everything move out here. We have neighbors are so rude and disrespectful. You know, it just, it's not safe anymore. Where we felt safe, you know, now we don't feel safe. So we'll be looking to move again. And hopefully this time we'll be moving into our own home. That, you know, because renting places is difficult. And when you have property managers and owners don't want to do the right thing, it's hard to, you know, but they want your money every month. But they don't want to do the right thing, what they should be doing, you know. But like I said, we praying that everything go through, that we looking for, that we end up getting us our own home next year when our lease is up. But I say, you know, I have been struggling all these years, going through all this back and forth, you know, with these doctors. You know, I end up, you know, changing all my doctors that I had. I have been through so many doctors, especially rheumatologists and pulmonologists. Those two doctors, I have went through a lot. And then we had to go through pain management. I was doing fine as long as my rheumatologist can give me my pain meds. But then they started, the state said it, where you have to go through pain management to get your pain meds. Okay, I did that for 6 months. Because after 6 months, they didn't want to give me my pain meds that I was on. I was taking 3 different type of pain meds, and those 3 different type of pain meds was helping me. So what they end up doing is taking me off all of them, and they just crippled me back to where I didn't want to go. I was constantly in pain. I couldn't move. It hurt to walk. It hurt to do anything. So my daughter asked me, she said, well, do you want to do the CBD, the legal way? I'm like, sure. You know, so what we did, we saved up the money to pay to see the doctor. And then we had to pay for the state license. And those have to be renewed every year. And every 6 months, you have to go and see the doctor. And that causes a lot of money. So during those 6 months, I'm saving so I could be able to pay to go see the doctor, and then saving to be able to get my license renewed for the next year. Because living on a fixed income is not easy. You know, I'm very grateful and thankful for the judge that set it up. So all my medical is covered, but I don't get to see that money because that money goes directly to my insurance. So I don't pay no co-pays or nothing like that. I can see any specialist I want. I can change doctors whenever I want. I have total coverage. I don't pay for no medications, prescriptions, or none of that. Because I pay a healthy deductible every month that comes out of my check. I don't get to see that. And the judge set it up that way because he said that I will have to see a lot of different specialists. I will have to have a lot of different surgeries. And that I have. I have had my left thumb infused. I have done my right hand totally reconstructed from my knuckles to my wrist to my inner, where they do the carpal tunnel surgery. I had that done. I had the ligament pulled down from my and my arms down so that I could be open to open my right hand again. I had both of my ankles replaced. I had my L4 and L5 done, infused. I have a titanium rod there. I had my C3 through 6 done that's in my neck. So like I said, I have had multiple surgeries, and all of this is because of the rheumatoid arthritis. And now I'm having this back pain again. It's in the middle of my spine. I don't know, is it the rheumatoid arthritis or the osteoporosis? So like I said, when I go see the doctor in December, hopefully he can tell me which one it is and what it's for, and if, you know, can it be taken care of? You know, every now and then I have a little problem with my hip, but it's not to that point where I think I need to have surgery yet. But I will address that with him when I go back and see him in December, that I'm having problem with my hips now. So it just one thing after another. But I'm blessed and I'm grateful and thankful to be here, because, you know, some people don't have that where, you know, they can be able to switch doctors when they want to, you know, have what they need. I have everything that I need and I want at my disposal. You know, like I said, I have went through so many doctors, and when I finally got my doctor team together, my internal medicine doctor ended up leaving, going to a different county. And so they didn't take my insurance. So I had to find all new doctors. Only new doctor that I did not have to end up with was my oncologist, my chemo doctor. I still have the same chemo doctor that I had when I first started my chemo back in 2009. So I've been with this doctor ever since then. I don't know, and I'm, you know, letting them all the new doctors understand that we all have to work together. We all have to communicate. Don't ignore my doc. You know, if one of my doctors send you an email or something telling you a concern or something, don't ignore that, because that is vital information that, you know, that can help you help me. And don't, you know, because I had a lot of doctors to tell me, oh, it's all in your head. What's in my head? It's right here in black and white documentation saying I have this, I have this. I didn't make this stuff up. I didn't do the lab work. You know, like I said, I went through a lot of those different changes with different doctors, you know, until I actually found a team that I can trust and that, you know, that listen to me and understand where I'm coming from. But like now, you know, I'm still working with these new doctors. And like I said, you know, one, my pulmonologist, he's great. You know, he listened, he understands where I'm coming from. I'm trying to get my rheumatologist and my internal medicine doctors on the same page, along with the other two doctors. So, you know, it's not that nobody's stepping on your toes. It's just we supposed to work as a team. And that's how I've been keeping myself alive, by having these doctors all work together so we can have a plan. You know, there's no, you know what he's doing, he know what you doing. And all of them, like I tell, anytime, whatever that's going on with me, send a copy, an email to my internal medicine doctor. You know, and I tells him, my rheumatologist, my oncologist, and my pulmonologist will be sending you emails of my visit with them, so you can compare it with your visit. We all have to work together, because that's the way you know, I've been doing it all these years and I don't need to start changing nothing now. You know, so if you all can get y'all doctors to work together, that's great, because that's what you need. You don't need, you know, some doctors feel like that other doctors trying to tell them how they do their job. It's not, they're not trying to tell you how to do your job. It's that they're trying to give you information that can help you to help your patient. And we as the patient got to open our mouth and say something to make sure these people are doing what they're supposed to do. You know, a lot of people ask me, you go through all these surgeries, you're not scared? When I go through surgeries, the day of the surgery, I go in there with a positive attitude. I have a big smile on my face, laughing and grinning and joking with the anesthesiologist, the nurses, and the doctors. So I make them feel at ease. So I know that they're going to take good care of me, you know, and that's all that you can do, you know. So stop being so rude. That's all you can do is, you know, have a great rapport with these people. Don't go in there nervous or looking all mad with an attitude and stuff. These doctors don't want that. They nervous enough as it is because they got to cut you. You're not cutting them. They got to cut you. So you want them to feel relaxed and calm. And a lot of them, when I go to the surgery, a lot of them be playing jazz music and it sounds so pleasant until I drift off to sleep. And when I wake up, I'm in recovery. I don't have no issues. I don't give these doctors no reason to say, oh, I don't want to be bothered with her. I don't do that. It's the same way with my internal medicine, my rheumatologist, my pulmonologist, and my oncologist. I do not give these doctors no grief, because I want them to help me. You know, I don't go in there with no attitude. If I have a issue or something, I tell there's something I need to address with you. If is it possible that we can talk about this before I leave? That's how I approach it. I don't go in there raising my voice with an attitude. I still have a smile on my face and everything. But it just, the way you come off to these doctors, a lot of these doctors don't want to be bothered. They hear up and get you in and out. They don't care. But I've been dealing with this illness for so long. With all the illness so long, I go in with a different attitude. Because, at first, before I start, I used to get frustrated and snap at them and look. I'm like, you know what? You better stop that. That's what I said to him. I said, you need to stop it. I said, because they can give you a pill to kill you and telling you it can help you and it can kill you. So I had to change my whole perspective on how to deal with these doctors. And especially the one that was telling me, oh, it's all in your head. Okay. Excuse me. But when I learned was, when they tell me it's all in my head and they say, well, stop at the desk and make your next appointment. I'm like, okay. I stop at the desk and I tell the lady that's making an appointment, I will not be coming back. I will be finding me a new doctor. Have a blessed day. And I leave. And leave it at that. They call me and want to know why I don't feel comfortable with the doctor. I call my insurance company. I tell them the reason why I'm leaving, because for once the doctor was rude, telling me it's all in my head. He think I'm just imagining all this. I need someone that's going to be on my side. So that's how I deal with doctors. And, you know, that's the way I've been doing it, and I have had, you know, no issues. I keep it moving. I don't have to sit and take your abuse, you know, because you feel you're in a bad mood and you want to, you know, you don't want to deal with my issues. I will find somebody that will want to deal with my issues and help me. I'm not going to be coming to no doctor, just paying you to come and you tell me, oh, it's all in your head. No, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to do that. That's a waste of my insurance money when I could be getting proper care. So I'm just saying, will y'all please take a look at how y'all doctors treating you and how you all treat them and change the way y'all think, you know, because they are human just like we are. And like I said, to me, when I go in with a good positive attitude, I come out with good results. You know, that just on my behalf. But if you think someone can benefit from listening to my podcast, pass it on. I really appreciate all the listeners, the subscribers. I really do. I am so grateful and thankful to you all. And I will be trying to update more often. But like I said, you know, when I'm not feeling good, I don't even want to pick up a phone or even pick up a computer to do anything. That's when I'm in a whole lot of pain. But again, I would like to say thank you all and namaste. Hello and welcome back to my channel. Today, I wanted to talk to you guys about what's been going on with me this month. This month had really been really rough for me. I started my third dose of chemo on the 5th of October. And after I had that dose, I normally bounce back within 24 hours after having my chemo. But this time I did not. It took me about from that Tuesday till that Sunday to actually start feeling a lot better. And it's just been one thing after another. And so I talked to my oncologist about it. And he said that by me having pneumonia back in June, that lowered my immune system even more. Although the chemo lowers my immune system too, but then having pneumonia on top of that, it just made it even worse. So he suggested that after I have my fourth dose to come back in 3 weeks, well, in 2 weeks after that, and end up getting 3 shots at different times to help try to build my immune system back up. But other than that, I'm feeling okay. I went and had my fourth dose on the 20th. And that one wasn't so bad. I was able to bounce back that Saturday. I feel a lot better today. And I went to see my pulmonologist on the 21st. And he gave me some good news. I'm no longer back on the oxygen permanently. I'm completely off of it. I don't have to carry my little portable anymore for no emergencies or nothing like that. And I don't have to sleep with it anymore. Only if I feel that I need it, he said, then I can use it. But I feel great. And I said I wasn't going to be on that oxygen forever. And I meant that. And I did it. And I'm off of it. And I am so proud of myself. And he wanted me to have another CT scan done of my lungs. He said he can still hear a little fluid in my lungs, not much, but he wanted to see how much fluid is there. And there is medication that I can be able to take to help with that if I'm not allergic to it, because mostly all the medication that they have out here now that are supposed to be helping me with all my autoimmune deficiencies, most of them I'm allergic to. So it's hard to find a medication that I can take to help me. But other than that, like I said, I'm feeling great. I'm hopeful and I'm, you know, very blessed, you know, that I'm here. And on the 26th, I have to go and see my internal medicine doctor for another checkup. And he had lab work for me to be done So I had that done. So I do have a copy of it if they don't have a copy already. So I have a copy for them. So we can discuss my iron levels, because my iron level is down to like 11. And then my other levels are not at the, where they're supposed to be at also. And I've been having problems with my blood pressure. The doctors them don't seem to be too much concerned, because the top number is still in the 3 digits, but it's the very low 3 digits that I'm concerned about, because my blood pressure normally runs me anywhere from 124 to over 78. And now it's running, when I went to have chemo, my blood pressure was running 106 over 30. And that was on the 20th. And then when I went to see the pulmonologist on the 21st, my blood pressure was 118 over 68. And they said all the time they're going to be more concerned about is when the top number dropped to 2 digits. So I'm going to see what it's going to be like on the 26th when I go in to have see my internal medicine doctor. And they sent him an email, you know, letting him know my concerns about, you know, my blood pressure. Because the blood pressure medicine I've been on it for 5 years. Maybe it's time to have it changed. And then the doctor said maybe it's not working anymore, because I had pneumonia, and that could have had effect on it also. So like I said, I'm very hopeful and thankful that I'm here. And they, you know, it just been one thing after another. In December, I go back to see the rheumatologist. Hopefully he have the bone density. If not, I have a copy for him of the report, so we can get started with this osteoporosis, because I'm having a lot of issues with my middle of my spine now. It hurts constantly. I can't stand that long. I can't walk that long. You know, it's really irritating. And I'm trying to do my cooking videos. My back gives out on me halfway through the videos. It hurts so bad. So it's just really been a problem, you know, since I got diagnosed with osteoporosis back in May. So it just, everything just hitting me now. I'm getting, it's a term that we call, that we talk about in the lupus chat group that I'm in. It's called brain fog. If the noise you hear in the background, that is me, so being very rude. But it's called brain, we call it brain fog. So with the brain fog, it's like a memory lapse that you have. And a lot of people don't think it's real, but it's actually real. I suffer with it. You know, at first I just played it off. I didn't pay it no attention. And then I started noticing it started getting a little more and more, to the point that, you know, I'm beginning to not remember stuff from 3 seconds from the living room to the kitchen. You know, it's just that bad. You know, I'm like, okay. So I went on the lupus website, and I was typing in, do anybody have memory lapse? And then they came back, oh, you talk about brain fog. Yes, you know, so there's a lot of people that goes through this that have lupus. And a lot of them was telling me, you know, as the illness progressed, they beginning to have more brain fog, you know, memory lapses and stuff. But I I always meditate anyway. I have my crystals around me all the time. So now If I'm trying to remember something that I need to do when I go into the kitchen to cook or something like that, I meditate and go into the meditate state and I see what I need to do. And as soon as I come out of that meditative state, I write it down before I forget exactly what I seen that I'm supposed to be doing, because it sometimes I lose it and sometimes I don't. But it's, you know, it's just things that happen. And that's one thing that people can, you know, pay attention to. If you have lupus, you will have those memory lapses where you forget what you're going to do in a quick of a second, you know. So that's another thing. But like I said, since I've been meditating and writing down what I need to do and help me remember what I'm supposed to be doing, it have been working for me. And I posted it, you know, in the lupus chat room also, and, you know, let people know, okay, this is what I've been doing to help me, you know, cough a lot. I'm trying to figure out, okay, what can I do? You know, the doctor said there's nothing they can do about that. Yeah. But to me, like I said, every little thing that we do to help each other that's going through different things is the best thing for us. Like I said, I suffer with so many autoimmune deficiencies, and I tried to learn a lot about each one of them. And since my lupus is progressing more, you know, it's just that I try to stay up on all the new stuff that's happening. Like I said, I always have used shea butter, pure shea butter, on my scalp. So when I go and get my chemo, it protects my hair from falling out. But with the lupus, you can lose your hair. And I noticed I have beginning to get little bald spots here and there in my hair. But I, you know, it's not falling out drastically. It's just little bald spots, you know, certain areas of my hair around my hairline. But I'm dealing with it. And I knew this was gonna happen because they had told me, as you know, this disease progress, it's gonna get worse. It's not gonna get better, you know. So I'm in that zone now where I was prepared way before now to know what to deal with. And another thing I would like to talk to you guys about. I have also been doing a video about how I cope with all of these autoimmune deficiencies from when I first got diagnosed up until now. And it's been really, really, really hard. You know, it was when I first got diagnosed back in 2004. I didn't have a clue what was going on with me. I was just recently divorced, and I had two kids. I had one that was in high school, one had just started middle high. And, you know, it was really hard as a single parent. So I had to work double hard to, you know, to be able to pay the bills, because my ex-husband, he did not pay alimony. None of that. He, you know, left the state just to keep from even going through that. And I didn't want to have to argue and fuss and fight with him about that. So I took on two part-time jobs along with my full-time job. So actually, I worked myself sick because, like I said, I had to pay the bills, you know, and my hands started swelling. I couldn't drive, I couldn't open doors, I couldn't even open a safe at work. And, you know, and I was a store manager, you know, and they depended on me to do certain things. And I couldn't even do that when my hands had got to that point. And then when I would walk, my knees would buckle. So I went in to see the primary care, and it was like, about 5 blocks from my house. So I walked up there. I fell a couple of times on my way there. And when I got there, I was so exhausted. I was fatigued and everything. So I signed in. they took me back and weighed me and everything, said the doctor being. So he came in and asked me, why is you here? I'm telling him, I'm having, look at me, I'm fatigued right now. I walked up here 5 blocks and I fell a couple of times on my way here. My knees buckled. My hands are swollen so big, I can't do anything. I couldn't even drive myself to the doctor's office. So that's why I ended up walking, because my hands were swollen so big. So he looked at my hands and he came back. He said, oh, wear these braces and I see you in a month. Didn't address my knee issue or nothing, but I learned a lot, when I first started going to these doctors. And that doctor made me start thinking and start asking more questions. So I went home, I wore the braces for a week and it didn't get any better. The braces was hurting my hands so bad I had to take them off. My hand had swollen up so tight, the braces was hurting. So I took the braces off and I walked up to the clinic again. And I had a couple of trips down on the ground before I got there, but I made it. So when I got there and I asked the lady, I said, is there any possible way that I could see another doctor? And I said, yeah, I was here just a week ago and I'm not satisfied with the treatment that I got from that doctor. So can I see another doctor? And she's like, okay, yes, we have one that's on staff here today. So they had me to sign in. The nurse came back and weighed me and took me in the back, put me in an examining room. Then the doctor came in and she asked me, she said, you look a little fatigued. I'm like, yeah, I fell a couple of times on the way up here because my knees buckled. And I said, my hands are swollen so bad, I can't even open doors or drive or anything like that. And I said, I was just here a week ago and the previous doctor told me I had carpal tunnel and gave me these braces to wear and I can't even wear them now because my hands are too swollen. And she went back and read the notes and said, so he didn't do no lab work. So she told the nurse to come in and go draw some labs. And she told me, she said, when I get your lab work back, I'll let you know what's going on, if there's anything that, that's actually going on with you. I'm like, okay. So when I went home, it was about 2:30 in the afternoon. The nurse called and said the doctor wanted to know, can I come back in? And she got my results and she wanted to talk to me about it. I'm like, okay. I said, it's going to give me a few minutes. I'm going to, take another slow walk back up there. So I walked back up to the clinic, signed in, the nurse came out and got me, and she took me back to the doctor's office. And I went in and had a seat. The doctor was sitting there looking over the lab work and stuff. And then she looked up at me and she said, okay, I know what's going on now. She said, you have lupus, you have scleroderma, you have fibromyalgia, you have pulmonary fibrosis, and you have rheumatoid arthritis. And another thing, there's no cure for none of these autoimmune deficiencies. And I'm like, who? What? So that's where that started at. So she's the only thing they can do is send me to different specialists, put me on medication that, to help with the pain. But she said, it's going to get worse over the years. It's going to get worse. She said, normally people with one of the autoimmune deficiencies that you have, they normally live anywhere from 7 to 10 years. And she said, by you got it 5 of them. She said, it's hard to say, I said, I'm not accepting that. So I went home. I was so distraught. I didn't know how to tell my kids. So I called my bishop and I asked him, could he come by? And I needed to talk to him, to help me explain to my children what is going on with me. So my bishop came over and I explained to him what was going on. And I told him, and then we set the kids down and we talked to them about it. And after that, I went back to my job. I wasn't able to go back to work. And I put in for my workman's comp. So I had that to live off for about almost a year. And after that, within that year was almost up, I wasn't able to pay my rent. Lucky my car was paid for. And I was just going through it. So I'm like, okay, now what did I do? I don't have a job. I don't have any more money coming in. The doctor had me apply for my disability. So when I went to try to get my unemployment, because my bishop told me, he said, maybe you can get your unemployment. So I went and tried to get my unemployment. They told me, by me applying for disability, I don't qualify for my unemployment. I'm like, okay. So after that, I didn't have no clue of what I was going to do next. And then it was time to pay the rent. Okay, I didn't have no money to pay the rent. So we end up losing our home. And one of the members of my church took my son in because they had a boy. And so they took him in. So it was just me and my daughter. So I had to swallow my pride. I called my sister that lived in Virginia at the time. And she passed away a year ago. And I called her and asked her, can my daughter come and live with her? And she said, we both can come. I told her, well, I just need somewhere for her to stay because I need to be here. So if I get a letter from the public housing, because I had applied for public housing, and if I get a letter, I need to be here. And so she said, okay. So I had to do a power of attorney for her, because in the state of Virginia, she couldn't do nothing for my daughter, like put her in school or take her to the doctor, anything or something. She needed that. So I had to give her power of attorney, temporary power of attorney to her while my daughter was staying with her. And so I came back here and didn't have nowhere to stay, but I still had my car. So I tried to stay at the shelter. They told me I couldn't stay there because I had a car. And this is for people that actually need somewhere that don't have anything. I'm like, okay. So next thing I did, I went and parked my car in a dark area on the church parking lot. And that's where I slept, in my car. And in the morning time, when they came in for seminary, I will park up front before they get there. And so I get a chance to see my son and stuff and find out, you know, how he's doing and everything. And while they was in seminary, I would go inside and wash myself up and change my clothes and stuff. And I told my son, I said, I see you tomorrow, you know, for seminary. So my kids actually did not know I was sleeping in my car on the parking lot. And then if I didn't sleep at the church parking lot, sometimes I would park on the Walmart parking lot and sleep at the Walmart. And I did that for 5 months, you know, moving around the different places, sleeping, because I didn't have nowhere for me to sleep, but I would always be back at the church in the morning time when the kids would go for seminary, if I can get a bath, you know, go in there and clean myself up and change my clothes and stuff and be fresh. But, and then one day my son called me and he said, Mama, you got a letter from public housing. I told him to open it up, cover my mail. I had it transferred to where he was staying at. So he opened it out and I told him, I said, so what is it? He said, you got approved. And they sent a list of places where you can go and look at. But I only had like 10 days to do that. I'm like, okay. So I told him, I said, well, I will pick you up from Job Corps, because he was going to Job Corps, but he wasn't living on campus. I said, I'll pick you up, and we're going to go and take a look at these places. And we went and looked. They all wasn't in a safe area or nothing like that. They all was in a bad area. And so we end up choosing one. So now I had to figure out how to get the light deposit to get the lights on. I had to figure out how to get money to get butane gas, because it was nothing. Only thing that was electric in that apartment was the light. The cooking was all electric power. It wasn't electric. It was butane. The heating was butane. So I had to figure out how I was going to get money to keep butane gas for us to heat by and to cook by. So what I end up doing is going, after I got all that situated and got moved in, and then I heard about the Section 8 program. So I went and signed up for the Section 8, and the lady asked me where I was at. I told her I was in public housing right at the moment. She said, well, you know, you have to stay there a year before you can leave. And within that year, after that year, your year is almost up. Then you can ask the property manager, you know, can you move? So during that time, I went to the Goodwill, and I found me a electric skillet and electric pots so I could save the butane gas and stuff. So when I was able, you know, I needed the butane gas for the heating and the hot water, you know, and everything like that. But that those electric pots and skillets came in handy for me when I was doing my cooking. So almost time for my year was up, I went up to the office and I talked to the property manager, and she was so nasty and rude, like, no, you cannot. I'm like, okay. So I went back down to the public housing authority, and I asked to speak to her supervisor, and I explained to them my situation, and I had got approved for public for Section 8, and I wanted to move, and she's telling me I couldn't move and wouldn't give me no good reason why I couldn't move. So her supervisor went over her head and told me, yes, I can go ahead and move. And the lady said, you know, you got so much going on, you're sick, you know, you don't need that extra stress. And I had been stressed out for a year just living in that apartment, you know, in that area that I was living in. And I was getting sicker and sicker, you know, and it was so bad to, you know, I thought you could talk to your doctor about your issues, or maybe they can help you talk to somebody. My doctor ended up admitting me in a mental hospital for 72 hours because she thought I was going to hurt myself or hurt somebody. I'm like, lady, I'm not going to hurt myself or no one. I just need someone to vent to. So I end up, because she said if I didn't go volunteering, she's going to have me Baker active. That means the police was going to be picking me up in front of my kids and taking me off to the mental hospital. So I went voluntarily. So I was there for 72 hours, and I went through their little program and everything, and I shared a room with four other women. So at night, when they would go to sleep, I would get up and get on my knees and I pray and I ask God to help me. If you just get me out of here, I would not question why I'm going through this, why this is happening to me. I embrace it. And that's what I did. And the next morning, went to our little section, and the doctor told me, he said, you don't have to go to the section. You can call someone to pick you up, or we can send you home in a cab. I was so happy to hear those words. I called the lady that where my son was staying and asked her, could she come and get me? And she's like, I'm discharged. Can you come and get me? She's like, yes. So she came and got me, and she took me back to her house. And that's when I picked up my car. So I couldn't drive myself there because they would be afraid that I would try to sneak out, you know, and leave. So I had to have someone drop me off. So she dropped me off, and then she took me back to her house to pick up my car. And then that's when I got the letter from Section 8, and that's when they told you can go and find, you know, somewhere on your own. We don't give you a list. So what I did, I started calling different apartment complexes and finding out, do y'all take Section 8? And I went through about 30 of them before I found one that said, yes, we do take Section 8. We have some available. Some of them that I was calling, yes, we take them, but we don't have nothing available. But this one place I called, they had available. They had a 3-bedroom available. She said, it's on the third floor. I don't care. what floor is on. Just if you got something. Excuse me. So I took that and I went and I let my bishop know, and members of the church came. They helped us move all our stuff out of that apartment area that we was in the public housing, and moved us into our new apartment. And I was very happy and blessed about that. But it took me 7 years just to get my disability. 7 years. And that was, it was ridiculous because they refused me. They kept denying me of my disability. And they denied me before to see the judge, go before the judge. And then me and my lawyer, we reapplied again. And then they actually end up letting me see the judge. So when I went before the judge, and he was like, why y'all deny her the first time? She had rheumatoid arthritis. At 15%, you are disabled, 100% disabled with rheumatoid arthritis. When I went before the Social Security medical, them people looked at